Hey there, everybody. It is Wednesday, September 26, 2012, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. And of course, go to the Facebook. You have an account. We know you do. Type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. Two of my favorite people around on this week's show, so we must get started. Hey, Sharon, are you ready to go?
I am.
She's already laughing. Let me introduce you. Sharon Staple is the executive director of the Anti-Violence Project, an organization whose mission it is to empower lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and HIV-affected communities and allies to end all forms of violence through organizing and education and support survivors through counseling and advocacy. Prior to joining AVP, Sharon was the director of the Family Domestic Violence Unit at South Brooklyn Legal Services. Before that, she supervised the Legal Aid Society's Family Law Units in the Bronx and Harlem and the Citywide Domestic Violence Unit. She's taught at the City University of New York School of Law and at Hunter College. And now she's back here with us another visit. Sharon Staple, Executive Director of the Anti-Violence Project. Welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you for having me, Ken. I love this show. It's so good.
And I had to cut things out of your bio or we would have no time to talk.
That was very impressive. Thank you for such a nice introduction.
You sound like a lawyer.
I'm a little bit of a lawyer, yeah.
What lens does the lawyer lens bring to the work that you do?
Gosh, you know, that's a really interesting question because The primary lens, I think, is that I actually used to represent AVP's clients in my practice. That's
okay.
How I got to know AVP. And so my first and sort of foremost lens is what's going on for the survivors that we're working with. But it does not hurt to be a lawyer and an executive director because there is so much that we do around administration and management of the organization where it helps to sort of have that fastidiousness lawyers have, myself included.
Well, you've not been on the show. It's been 8 months. You were on our 150th.
Has it really been that long?
Oh, no kidding. It's you were on our 150th show. This is show number 183.
Wow.
So my assumption is that in the past 8 months, we've solved violence.
Yes. I've been very busy.
Yes.
Actually, I have to say, in the past 8 months, we have seen an enormous amount of progress in this country around the recognition of the violence.
Okay.
Which is always sort of the first step, right? And I don't know, I'm sure you've been faithfully following my Facebook account, so you'll know.
It's what I do when I wake up in the morning.
But in earlier this year, in the spring, the U.S. Senate passed a version of the Violence Against Women Act, which is the primary legislation in the country that works to end intimate partner and sexual violence. And so they passed a version of that law that was explicitly LGBT inclusive.
Yes.
Which was fantastic. I mean, first of all, it's a law that is critically needed for LGBTQ survivors and for people who experience violence. But it also meant that there were hours and hours of debate on the Senate and then eventually the House floor about the needs of LGBTQ survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first time, you know, ever in this country that we have had that public a debate about this, these communities and their specific needs. And, you know, it wasn't all pleasant, as you might imagine.
Right.
But it was all critical, I think, in terms of raising awareness and raising the conversation as a whole across the country. So the bill then went on to pass the House without the explicit LGBT inclusion, and we are now in sort of limbo, waiting to see whether the bill gets reconciled between the two houses or whether we start this all over again next year. But even with that sort of deflated ending, which, you know, this Congress has not passed a number of laws,
right,
including this one. But even with that, I think what we've done is we have, you know, motivated the White House to put out statements on the issue of LGBTQ anti-violence. We have been talking with the Department of Justice about how to address this in a really comprehensive way. We've been seeing op-eds throughout the country that calls for the need to include queer survivors in federal legislation. And I think that that really is a sea change. And, you know, so yeah, so we've done that in the last 8 months. How's that?
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. I would love to focus our attention, because I think that we don't go here enough. I certainly don't go here enough on the show, and talk about violence that is directly connected to HIV-affected communities, because I don't think that gets the same play.
I don't think so either.
What's that about?
So I totally agree with you. I think, you know, there is often an assumption that folks who are affected, and we use affected with the A instead of the IS.
Yes, yes, that's so, affected. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's often an assumption that folks who are affected by HIV are also people who identify as LGBT. And that sometimes is true, but that's not always true, right? So when you're looking at the very specific issues that folks who are HIV affected face, you A, can't assume sexual orientation or gender identity in the same way that we can't assume sexual orientation or gender identity in any case.
Right.
But, you know, we are mission-driven to serve LGBTQ and HIV-affected folks. And actually quite a few of the people that we serve are heterosexual, some of them who identify as transgender and some of them who don't. So we have a core group of heterosexual folks that we serve. But I think that's sort of the very first thing, is that we're not necessarily talking about queer anti-violence. We may be talking about a specific type of anti-violence work. And then I think just the way that the person who is HIV affected experiences violence can be very specific to the fact that they are HIV affected, right? And so the ways in which people use bias or stigma or slurs may be different when they're related to HIV. Access to medical treatment may be different.
Right.
Intimate partner relationships, if they are violent, may use the fact that the partner is HIV affected in a very specific way to be abusive, by withholding medications or threatening to out someone about their HIV status. And those things are different than sexual orientation and gender identity. And so we separate that, or it's not that we separate it out really, because most of our trainings are comprehensive in a lot of ways, but we pay particular attention to what are those specific differences and what do we need to address those things, and not assume that it's the same solution for every problem.
Right. Well, I wanted to get into what I'm sure that you do every night over dinner, and that's the strategic plan of AVP. I was reading it. I was reading it before. Is it required reading?
You've done your homework.
I do my homework. I assume it's required reading for me to get a job there, which we'll talk about later. So there are a couple pieces of the strategic plan, which everyone can check out. I don't enjoy when organizations don't have their strategic plan online. I think it's important.
Yes, we thought it was too. We thought it was really critical to be as transparent as possible about where we're going to go in the next 3 years.
Well, I want to talk about two pieces of that, and there are a lot of different moving parts. But one, I love this phrase, advance community-based accountability models. Tell everyone what a community-based accountability model. You know, as someone who is an elected official, and I am teaching a course this semester on how do we define the word community and what can communities do, I love the idea of an approach that's not just individual, but that has to do with the community.
Yes. So I think there probably isn't one particular way to define community-based accountability. I think we conceptualize it as exactly what you're talking about, Ken, which is it starts in the communities and it is community-driven. And so it's not, it may be a part of the criminal legal system. It may not be,
okay.
Right? It could be as simple as an awareness campaign that raises awareness in a community that this anti-LGBTQ violence is not going to be tolerated, and people are going to speak out about it, and they're going to create a culture in which it is shameful to say anti-LGBT things or to hate someone for being LGBT, right? So it can be like that, can be holding people within your community accountable. It can be like a pilot project that we're working on right now with the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, where they are with certain low-level hate crime offenders, they are, instead of incarcerating the person, giving them the opportunity to go through a community-based program.
Great.
Through the Museum of Tolerance. And we are a part of that. And the purpose there is to bring community members together to educate this person who has you know, perpetrated this violence, but perhaps not really understood what all that was about, or perhaps didn't really intend to do that, or could change their mind or attitudes, and to really talk to that person about the impact that their behavior had and ways in which they can go about changing it. And then, you know, I think there are other community-based accountability models that are a little more formalized and are used actually in lots of communities to avoid going through the criminal legal system, because they don't want to see their community members incarcerated. They want to see their community members changing, right? And those are much more complex and much more formal. But that it's also, that also encompasses, that's also encompassed in what we're sort of thinking about in terms of community-based accountability model.
But I love the idea that, that there is room for each community, as each community has its own identity, to respond in a slightly different way so that it's culturally appropriate. Love that.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that you, you know, we are not going to solve the problem of violence by putting people in jail. Like, I really strongly believe that. I don't think it's a deterrent. I think we're going to change the, we're going to solve the problem of violence by making it as embarrassing and unacceptable to be anti-queer as it is to be racist, or as it is to be ableist, or any of those things where you sort of know you're not supposed to say that, and you know that it's not okay to judge people on those things. Like, that's the kind of shift that we really need around homophobia and biphobia and transphobia.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, the other piece I wanted to talk about, and I know it's not the splashiest or the flashiest, but we've been increasing our airtime on this show, So Gay, talking about fundraising. Because I think I'm noticing more and more, it kicked off when our buddy Jimmy Nguyen wrote an op-ed for The Advocate just about how the LGBT community is not giving at as high rates as we could possibly be giving, in fact, at quite low rates. And that's kind of balanced out by the fact that if you are on the right mailing list, you get a deluge of emails asking. I mean, one thing happens in Congress and you get an appeal from a ton of different organizations. So given that there is a little bit of a crowded landscape, and we're going to talk with Dennis from the Victory Fund about this a little later on in the show. Given that there's a crowded landscape, how does AVP put itself out there to really get the funds that, that you guys need to operate, given that there's so many other people asking for the same money?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about relationship building, really, first and foremost. Like, we call it fundraising and friendraising, right?
Lovely.
Because you need to build a relationship with folks. And, you know, I'm a strong believer in this idea of equality. And I think that equality has often been sort of shorthanded as marriage equality or employment non-discrimination. And I think all of those things are critically important. But for me, the fundamental question about whether we have achieved equality is whether people are safe in their homes and in their streets, right?
Right.
And I think if people understand that message and you can have a conversation with folks about why that's so important and meet them where they are, what are they interested in and what do they have to say about it, you build a relationship where people feel really invested in the organization and the organization's success, right?
Yeah.
And I think people can contribute to nonprofits in a lot of different ways. I mean, I'm very serious when I say fundraiser, because we do a lot of work with volunteers and through committees with that are comprised of volunteers. And it's critical to our success that we have that kind of expertise available to us and that we are able to engage as many people as possible. And yes, we need the dollars to pay the rent and to make sure the lights are on and all of that stuff. But really what we need to do is build a movement where people feel like this issue is their issue, this organization is their organization, and this victory will be their victory as well.
Well, I don't know how people would not feel that way given the sheer amount of moving parts that you guys have going on right now. Quite frankly, you don't have time to be talking to me right now. I'm appreciative, but
it's only because I love you.
Okay. Well, yeah, you need to get over that, because I'm looking here at all the different things. We've so much to talk about. You don't have time for this, but let's highlight some of them. Now, I was really interested in this Communities United for Police Reform.
That's Thursday.
Yeah, that's this week, that you guys are joining with. And it implies that there is perhaps some work to do with the New York Police Department.
Yes, and that implication, I think, would be correct.
Okay. Um,
So we are coming out on Thursday, tomorrow, on Thursday the 27th, with a bunch of different groups who are related to Communities United for Police Reform, and we work closely with them, to basically take a stand against the stop and frisk policies of the NYPD,
okay.
Which was also the subject of a we joined with the NAACP and the National Action Network in June, and during their Father's Day silent march to end stop and frisk and racial profiling, I was one of the LGBT table co-chairs for that march, because we know that the same issues that impact people of color in this city around stop and frisk and racial profiling impact LGBTQ people in this city, because very often they are the same people. And we also know that additionally that folks are profiled for being queer and very specifically profiled for being transgender or gender nonconforming. And so we think that it is critical that in order to ensure safety for all people in New York City, that the NYPD is held accountable to a fair standard of when they stop and frisk people, and that they don't do it just because someone looks different than they think they should look,
right.
Which is often, you know, the basis for stop and frisk. And so this work is a part of the overall work we're doing with the NYPD. I sit on the Police Commissioner's Advisory Committee, and we recently just promulgated some patrol guidelines that for the first time ever explicitly include transgender and gender nonconforming people and
great.
The way in which the NYPD should interact with them. So I think all of these things are really critical. But the issue of stop and frisk is really one that is it is so incredibly disruptive to so many people's lives, and it doesn't, from anything that we can see, actually increase safety in this city. In fact, it makes people less safe. So we want to do something about that.
Okay, so you got that going on. Apparently you have something to do tomorrow night. You're just not maybe sure what it is, or you might be going.
I have to check my date book. Oh, right. So tomorrow night is actually also our big gala. We have once a year we have the Courage Awards, where we take the opportunity to really acknowledge and recognize our partners throughout the year who we think have shown enormous courage in the face of violence or bias or discrimination, mm-hmm. and working to end that violence and bias and discrimination, and who have had a real impact on the lives of LGBTQ people, victims and survivors, communities, all of us.
So what are you wearing?
I'm wearing a red dress.
Lovely.
Yes, it's very exciting. I'm not a dress kind of girl.
Okay.
So there will be some practicing of walking in heels. But it is quite the fancy kind of do, so it's fun. We all get sort of dressed up. Well, I think the better question to ask is, what is the AVP staff wearing? Because they are far better dressed than I am at every single one of these events.
As I learned on ER, you set the tone. That's my big favorite
yes,
phrase.
So I think in this case that cannot possibly be true. I very much dress in the Granimals fashion, right? So the staff here is far more creative than I am.
I am your leader. No, not now, but normally.
Exactly. Don't look at what I'm
wearing. I am your leader.
Exactly.
So now, what kind of research did you need to do to write my bio for the podcast award there at the Courage Awards?
It was very intense research, almost on par with what you've done today.
It's very exciting.
No, it's really, it's such a really, really wonderful night, because it is an opportunity to sort of step back from the very, very hard and often, you know, intense work that we do, and really take a minute and say, look at all these people. Look at how much we appreciate all these people.
It's great.
Let's throw a party.
We love parties. Where is the party?
It's at this place called Studio 450, which is sort of the Chelsea West.
Lovely.
Kind of thing.
Lovely.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. If any of your listeners are interested, they're welcome to come down.
Or even the host. Anyone who can
exactly.
wants to go.
Well, you have a standing invitation.
Oh, well, thank you. Now, I have to ask, I want to talk a little bit about New York City, because there certainly have been incidents, although I feel like you are perpetually responding to incidents there in New York City. And there's a very interesting balance there, because we certainly bill New York City as a haven of sorts, as one of those places to go in the world if you're coming out as LGBTQ, HIV affected, you know, as a very welcoming place. And then it makes it perhaps that much more jarring when you guys put out a press release of something very violent and something very anti-LGBT that's happened in New York City.
Yeah, I think, you know, so we recently, last week, we had an incident in Chelsea, which is considered to be sort of the gay mecca of the world, and at a McDonald's there. And this is not the first incident we've had at that McDonald's there. So it's you know, I think that it is absolutely jarring. I think, you know, if we think about this from New York City versus the rest of the country, certainly New York is far more resourced with you know, positive and pro-LGBT services and supports and places to hang out and attitudes and all of that. So it's not, you know, I think New York is a place where people do feel like they can be more open and more true in who they are. But I also think it's not a safe haven that everyone thinks it is. We still see the same kinds of violent incidents and sometimes and really sort of the most shocking, we see them in very well-known LGBT neighborhoods or, for example, last year we saw an incident at the Stonewall Inn, which,
blew my mind,
you know, like, how do you go into a gay bar and gay bash someone? Like, I still can't wrap my head fully around that. Right. But it happens.
And
I think, you know, each incident happens for very specific reasons. And if, you know, if we look at the McDonald's incident, for example, you know, this McDonald's happens to be really close to the piers where a lot of LGBTQ youth hang out. When it gets dark, they go to McDonald's to hang out some more and get something to eat for pretty cheap. And, you know, when you've got a large concentration of queer youth in, you know, a very busy city, things are going to happen. And I think what we need to look at here is, you know, we've done all of the sort of obvious things that you do. You know, we've done outreach in the neighborhood. We've talked to the McDonald's staff. Like, we're on a committee with the city council to address this issue from sort of a legislative or policy perspective. But really we need to look at, like, what is the problem here? Like, what's the need here? And I think what we see is that we have LGBTQ youth who want a place to hang out and eat and be safe. And, you know, that looks a lot like a drop-in center to me. Like, I think McDonald's cannot be the drop-in center of the West Village. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, we need something that addresses the root of what's going on and not just sort of, you know, better training. Because better training is fine. It's great. It's something we should pursue. But it's not the answer, right?
Yeah. Yeah, people need to check that out, to listen to this week's episode when it comes out, which will be – did it already come out, the Out FM?
Oh, yes. I think it went out yesterday.
Okay, so people should check that out because it's Sharon talking on that episode and also Kate Barnhart, who's the director of the New Alternatives Drop-In Center for Homeless LGBT Youth. And you have to talk about some of these things together because we have a real issue, particularly in New York City, with LGBT youth, certainly nationally, but where funding is being slashed left, right, up, and down for programs that serve homeless youth and in particular LGBT youth, it's a real issue in New York.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also the other person who was on the show is Jay Dulani, who's the co-director at Fierce, which is an organization that is community run and led by LGBT youth and has really been doing a lot of work around campaigns for a drop-in center in the West Village. So it was actually a really great interview. And, you know, frankly, I learned a lot listening to Dulani and Kate.
So people can go to outfm.org to listen to that. And then I assume that we will get notice of the AVP bake-off's got to be coming up, right?
Yes.
Or did you already declare yourself the winner?
Yes. I think that me entering a bake-off is probably a pretty bad idea. I'm not really well known for my cooking or baking, you know?
Or fashion, apparently. It's baking
really,
or fashion.
Honestly,
okay. But you're
honestly,
a lawyer.
Apparently I'm a lawyer. I'm a minister, you know?
Great.
I know. I have managed the fashion. I've managed the Garanimals look. I feel like I could pull that off.
But it's
much
good.
More than that, I don't get too interesting. But yes, a bake-off. I think that's actually a fabulous idea. And I will say that we have once a year these staff retreats where we go and play in a park somewhere and do, you know, team building and stuff, and it's a potluck. And people bring things, and I just think, like, how on earth are people talented enough to make all of this food. So I feel like we would raise $1 million if we had the AVP staff do a bake-off. Let me say that.
Can I get a commitment on This Show Is So Gay on today, September 26th, that I can MC the AVP bake-off?
Oh, my God. Please, that would make it. That would be fantastic.
All right, it's next week. I'll send you guys all the directions. It's going to be great. Let's give them a couple days to recover from the Courage Awards, and then
we'll start baking in earnest.
Yes. Everyone, please meet at the Duplex next Friday night for the AVP. No, that's not good.
A bake-off at the Duplex. That's fantastic. Really, we need you to come and do some development work.
I'm here to help. I am here to help. Hey, Sharon, where can folks go to learn all about the amazing things that the Anti-Violence Project is doing?
They can go to our website, which is avp.org. Or they can go to our Facebook page, which is Facebook/antiviolence. And we are now on Twitter, which is very exciting, at antiviolence. So there's lots of places you can go. The website is probably the most comprehensive place, but like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter.
So many different ways to be anti-violence and pro-community.
Yes.
That's what we want. That's what we want. Sharon, you know you're one of my favorites.
Oh, Ken, I have such a great time. Thanks so much for inviting me and for spending the time with me. I really appreciate it. And I'm starting to plan my baking menu now.
I'm so excited. I have all these jokes lined up at the intersection of AVP and baking. Okay, I don't have anything yet, but I'm going to come up with some really good stuff.
It's going to be awesome.
Hey, yes. Tell your staff to just have the most amazing night tomorrow night at the Courage Awards. I think that so many organizations, I'm not saying that they fold, but it's certainly a struggle when they don't take the time to actually celebrate. And it's not in any way to imply that you don't have so much work to do. And certainly the work that you all are doing there, you and your staff are doing there, it is some heady work and it can be really emotional. And it's a cycle that's really tough to break, but that you are taking the time to celebrate, to say there are people making a difference here and we're a part of that is so important to just the organization thriving.
Oh, I'm so glad you think that. I think that too. And I think tomorrow is sort of one of the more interesting juxtapositions of our work, right? Because during the day we'll be in the streets marching and rallying.
Right.
At night we'll be in our glad rags, you know, celebrating and appreciating. So
yes.
It'll be kind of a perfect, if very busy day.
Yes.
So thanks, Ken.
There is not to be any stopping and frisking though there at the Courage Awards.
No.
I'm just saying. It's not that kind of party, people.
It is.
It's not that kind of party.
Not.
All right. Well, we look forward to the pictures and the red carpet and all of that and that red dress. We are excited. Sharon Staple, always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, Ken. I hope to talk to you really soon. Don't wait 8 months.
Yeah. I think so. Have a great time tomorrow.
Thank you.
At the start of the conversation, I didn't have too much to say. I was needing some inspiration and you just got in my way. Took a shot at an easy target, you were too stunned to say anything. You were the unsuspecting martyr, you were not the most dangerous game. Bring my courage back now, bring it back to me. Tired of being afraid of what I can't change. Won't be living free. Well, it could be that I was mistaken. Maybe I deceived myself. But it's hard to understand somebody doesn't want to understand himself. There's an ocean of unlatched windows, a world of unlocked homes. Only reason anybody can still feel safe is most people still knock on the door. Bring my courage back, now would you bring it back to me? I'm tired of being afraid of what I can't change, it won't be living free. I don't want to be a prisoner, bound in these chains. Don't want to be a prisoner, want to be free again. take the road to Damascus. Some take the road to hell. I'll take Highway 1 to the evergreens. And everything will turn out well.
All right, folks, and we are back. Second guest welcoming to the show, Dennis Dyson, is the Vice President of Communications for the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund, an organization working towards changing the face and voice of America's politics and achieving equality for LGBT Americans by increasing the number of openly LGBT officials at all levels of government. He hasn't been on the show in quite some time, and according to our podcast directory, he's never been on the show. Dennis Dyson, welcome to this show, Is So Gay.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me.
I'm not saying that there are bad omens associated with you being on the show, but we've had our mishaps.
This is true. I've actually never quite appeared on the show.
But it's different. It's an election year. It's different now. Everything is different now. So I don't know if you guys know down there at the Victory Fund, it is indeed an election year.
We've heard.
You've heard.
We've definitely heard.
What's the vibe in the office?
We just got through endorsing our final slate. We endorse monthly, so we just got through with our final slate, and we are at, drum roll please, 175 endorsed candidates for the year, which is a new record for us.
Wow. And so do you have to break down each one into, like, viable candidate, not viable candidate? We think we can elect all 175, right?
Absolutely. That's what we're going for.
Okay.
Our win rate has typically been anywhere from 65 to 75%, sometimes a little higher. We're aiming for 100 every year, of course, and this year would be particularly sweet given the huge numbers that we've endorsed. But we're through all of our primaries now as well, so it's a mad dash to November 6th.
Because if I was in that 175 and I read you guys putting out a statement saying we're hoping for 95% elections, electability, I'm thinking, wait a second, am I in the 5%? So it's good to go for 100.
Absolutely. Every year. 100.
Well, let's back up a step. Why do we need an organization like the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund?
Well, you know, there's about 500,000 elective offices in the United States, and by our count, only about 530 of those are occupied by openly LGBT office holders, and that's clearly not enough.
Right.
We are able to, as not only activists but as out officials, we're able to impact the debate when we're in the room. You know, an old saying in Washington is if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu.
Right.
We're trying to get more people at the table who can speak authentically about their lives, about their families, especially when issues that affect our lives come up. And so having somebody like Tammy Baldwin in the United States Senate would be a milestone for a lot of reasons, but not least of which that she would be the very first openly LGBT senator in U.S. history.
I don't think that we can pause long enough on that one. This would be huge, would it not?
It would. It's, you know, she's been in the House since 1998.
Right.
And she has been able to impact the debate tremendously there, along with people like Barney Frank and Jared Polis and David Cicilline. But the Senate is a different animal.
Yeah.
It's 100 people, not, you know, 435. They represent, obviously, entire states. And there's a lot more power that each one of them hold to either advance something or to block something. It's just mind-boggling the amount of power an individual senator has. We have never had a member of our community in that position. And she would certainly be the highest-ranking openly gay elected official in U.S. history. So it would be a sea change.
All right. So we have our eye on that. What other races are we looking at these days?
We also have 7 House races, which is another record for us. We've endorsed 8 total federal candidates this year, 7 for the House. Now, you know, Tammy Baldwin is leaving the House for the Senate race. Barney Frank announced that he was retiring.
Right.
I think a lot of people thought we would backslide a little bit in terms of our numbers in the House. But the quality of the people running and the number of people running give us hope that we absolutely will at least hold and possibly even expand our numbers in the House.
Oh, that would be amazing. That would be amazing. I would like a gay governor. Has that happened yet?
One has come out while in office, and I think he resigned in the next breath. So.
Yeah, that didn't go so well.
for a brief shining moment, we had a gay governor of New Jersey, but there has never been a gay candidate elected. An openly gay candidate elected to a state house.
Well, I do want to stop you right there, because that's kind of an interesting piece of all of this, is knowing that you do have to put the word openly in there, which is something very intentional in all of your press releases and everything that you guys put out there. And I always have to stop myself and say, oh, that's right. We have to say openly.
Right. Right. And that's the part that matters, you know, to us.
Yeah.
It doesn't help us much if somebody is secretly gay,
right,
and runs for office, or secretly gay while in office, because they're really not speaking as a member of our community. They may be an ally, or they may not be, as we've seen in some,
right,
in some other instances. But to have somebody who is out and honest with the constituents, who then still gets elected, who still has their trust to represent them, entire communities, not just the gay community, that makes a difference. And
yeah.
I think when some of these people are elected to the House, they're coming with the same support that every other member there has. You know, every House district is roughly 500,000 constituents, and so everyone's vote is equal.
Right.
They know they're representing those folks. And so, you know, if somebody like Richard Tessay from Massachusetts gets to go into the Republican caucus and speak as an elected official sent there by 500,000 people in his district, that really is different than just having an advocate who may or may not get the ear of somebody.
Yeah, I must say that we see those Richard Tessay commercials quite a bit here in Southern Vermont. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of commercials out there, I must say. Now, since you were last, shall we say, allegedly on the show Is So Gay, I actually myself, and I know our listeners have heard me talk about this quite a bit, I went through the Victory Fund endorsement process and proudly filled out all the paperwork and even more proudly received the endorsement, which, by the way, people may not know this, it comes with a phone call from the executive director. It's very exciting. It's not just a letter, but then Chuck Wolf calls you and leaves you a phone message. That's fun. And then ran for office and was elected and am proudly one of those 530 roughly out elected officials. But I must say that one of the interesting things about running for office around here in Southern Vermont was when I got that endorsement, I quite naturally put it out there to people. Hey, I'm about many things, but this is one piece of who I am. And the only resistance that I got, Dennis Dyson, the only resistance was from local members of the LGBT community who did not want attention drawn to it. And I was not anticipating that.
That is interesting.
Not something you guys have heard of before? Please don't say I'm an anomaly. I can't handle that today.
I think they wanted to keep you down on the farm.
There you go.
Inspector.
Yes. It's a fence viewer if you're going to...
No.
And now I'm a selectman. It's almost like a real thing.
No, I haven't heard much of that. I think the more common response to people is that they are proud that a member of their community is running for office, and especially if they win, they know that they have somebody in office who is speaking for a pretty unique set of concerns. I can't imagine that there are not still pockets where people just kind of want that not to be a topic of discussion. They want to live their lives and have everyone else leave them alone. Would that, you know, we had that luxury across the nation that people would leave others alone who they know to be gay. That's just, you know, my experience is it's usually not possible.
Right. It's not. And the fact that people are insisting that it is actually a different issue that we're having. One of my favorite things that happens in my email inbox twice a week is the Gay Politics Report. And it's the best. Quite frankly, I don't know that there would be this show Is So Gay without the Gay Politics Report on Tuesdays. Fridays, it always comes a little bit late for me. But the Tuesdays, for people who don't know about the Gay Politics Report, and my hope is that the subscription rate is just through the roof, because it is one of the most amazing repositories of knowledge out there.
Thank you very much. It's been a labor of love for me for a number of years. I think I've been writing it now for, oh my gosh, 8 years.
Wow, look at that.
Since well before I worked at the Victory Fund. So It is a twice weekly news aggregator email, and I try to summarize for our readers in just a couple sentences all of the major LGBT political stories of the week. So we get usually get in about 15 summaries in each email. So if you just skimmed it twice a week, you would get kind of the top 30 stories in LGBT politics for the week.
Who comes up with the poll questions?
That is yours truly.
Look at that. This is a huge day for me. This is a much bigger interview than I thought it was, to be honest with you. I adore you and I adore the work that you do, but I didn't know that you write the polls.
That's the hardest part.
I would imagine so.
It's usually the thing that, that is, you know, I have a 10 a.m. deadline on the morning that it comes out, and I'm at 9:58, I'm running around the office asking people for ideas about polls.
Lovely. Because I must ask you, Dennis, if the U.S. presidential election were held today, how would you vote? I had to look up really what Gary Johnson was all about because that was one of my options.
And you know he's beating Mitt Romney right now on that poll.
I know. I just clicked on it because I wanted to see. All right. So that's – so how do people subscribe to that? And what's the subscription rate looking at? Oh, by the way, Barack Obama currently at 94.35% there on the Dennis Dyson poll, which by from now on I'm calling it the D squared poll. I'm very excited about that.
Thank you. You can subscribe for free. Anyone can. By going to smartbrief.com/LGBT. SmartBrief is the company that kind of puts it together, edits my crazy prose, and makes it look respectable. They also deal with our subscription and unsubscribe process. So smartbrief.com/LGBT.
Can we talk a little bit about the emotional side of it? I'm kind of curious. There are some weeks, and sometimes twice a week, where and it's no fault of your own, Dennis. It's not you creating all the news, but there is nary a pro-LGBT story to be found. You know, it's just, there's some editions that it's just really rough because there's a lot of either defeats or anti-gay things being said or something with waffle fries, whatever it may be. For you, as someone who puts it together, how do you deal with kind of the emotional side of aggregating what some weeks are very depressing stories?
Well, I try to approach it as a journalist would, and give people a kind of an unbiased view of the news as much as I possibly can. I have a personal bias, but I try not to inject that into it. And so I want people to understand the advances we've made and the good news, but also to understand that we're not done, and there are times where we really have to fight back. You know, the Chick-fil-A story is you're going to find this fascinating. Chick-fil-A story is a particularly interesting one to me because I used to work at Chick-fil-A.
No, you didn't.
When I was about 16 years old.
Where? At Paramus Park in Paramus, New Jersey. Where was it?
In the Orange Park Mall in Orange Park, Florida.
Look at that.
So, I mean, I spent 2 years as a teenager working for the company, and
so you took this particularly hard, this Chick-fil-A story.
And I like my chicken sandwiches.
Those are some good waffle fries, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, so it's been an interesting story to follow. You know, I remember as a kid, I was one of the only Catholics that worked in our particular Chick-fil-A store. Everybody was a member of the Southern Baptist Youth Group of the owner of that particular store. They had a sign in the back of the store that said that the purpose of the company was to glorify God and everything that they did, etc.
Wow.
So it was always a little bit alienating for me, but
on so many levels, apparently.
Whole new level these days.
Wow. I have to say, one of the other things that I love about the brief is that it really does feature international stories as well, which are sometimes really tough to come by in mainstream LGBT press, that as it turns out, Dennis, there's a whole big world out there, and LGBT stories all over the world.
There are, and some of them are, when we talk about depressing stories, the ones that come from international, from the international angle can be truly, truly depressing. The stories coming out of Africa in particular, and then Uganda,
yes,
have been. I mean, we talk about some of the fights that we're dealing with here and the progress that we've made, but the international community is really crying out for the LGBT community in America to help them. And we hear it all the time, and I hope that we can shed a little light on what's going on in some of the areas of the world where it is still not only hard to be out, but illegal.
Yeah. And I chuckle because I just this morning got my plane tickets to return to Uganda, and so I would ask that my mother not listen to this show, because I like her in the dark as much as possible. But I will be safe, Mom. Dennis and I guarantee my safety, I promise you. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. Any other races that we should be – I like when we talk about the people that there's no way we would have heard about. So, sure, Tammy Baldwin, and she's going to be a senator, and look at the polls. And so exciting that she's leading in the polls, and it's looking good, but people still need to get out the vote there. What's on the other end of the spectrum, a race that we may not hear about?
One of the things that we've been working on this year is to make sure that every state house in the United States has at least – or every state legislature has at least one out – state lawmaker. We think that's important for a number of reasons, but there are, at the beginning of this year, there were 17 that had none, including places like Florida and Texas. Well, we know based on primary results where the race is determinative that at least four of those states are coming off that list. Texas, Florida, New Mexico, and Pennsylvania. Will all have their first or only out state legislators. And there's one that we're still working on, and that's West Virginia.
Okay.
Stephen Skinner, who's running for the House of Delegates in West Virginia, has a very good chance of winning and becoming the state's first out state legislator.
That would be amazing.
West Virginia, this is going to be huge. You know, they're not at the same place that Vermont is.
Right.
Or California, so we've got to start somewhere, and having that first person win is a really important milestone.
Now, do you have different standards for, say, Vermont, whereas we're looking for one from each state? You guys want a minimum of maybe 15% of the state legislature to be LGBT here in Vermont?
At minimum.
And let's pull back the curtain. I'm just asking, do you guys celebrate perhaps a little less when one of the Vermonters gets elected because you assume it's going to happen?
No. We're trying to build a secondary goal is to build what we call LGBT caucuses, which is five or more legislators, because we've seen that that can have a real impact on the legislation that they pass. So Maryland, which passed marriage equality last year, has eight out state legislators.
Great.
And Washington State has six, and they've passed a marriage bill, and New York has six, and they passed a marriage bill. So if you looked at a map of which states have the most state legislators, you could overlay a map where they have passed some form of relationship recognition, mm-hmm. either domestic partners or marriage, and it would match up almost evenly. It's truly amazing the impact that out legislators can have on their colleagues.
Can you also just tell us a little bit about the endorsement process? I've having gone through it, you know, I wasn't accepting funds and there weren't going to be commercials to be elected selectman. I did have lawn signs, and if you guys need one, the Czechneck lawn signs, it really was a catchphrase of a generation. So you guys let me know if you need me.
What was the catchphrase?
Czechneck. It was big. It was big, Dennis.
I want one.
Dennis, I'm sending one to you. Talk to us a little bit about like what it is that you're looking for.
Well, candidates come to us and request endorsement. At that point, we will do. They must fill out an application and a questionnaire, and we do an evaluation of the race and their viability in the race. The first thing we do is make sure that they meet all of our endorsement criteria. Viability is the one that's the hardest to determine, and we have to go make a lot of phone calls and talk to people on the ground and in those districts and ask them what they know about the candidate and what are the odds that they could win this race. What we're looking for is a path to victory, not necessarily an assured victory.
Mm-hmm.
If you can demonstrate that path, if you have shown us how you're going to raise the money and how you're going to spend it, and that there is a path for you, we will endorse you. And that we're endorsing probably about half the people who apply right now. So it's not enough just to be openly LGBT and decide that you want to, that you should be in government. You have to be, a candidate who understands what it takes to win and is willing to do that.
And you look at some really exciting things happening, and we certainly had him on the show last year, but when Alex Morse was elected in right. nearby Holyoke, just 35, 40 minutes down the road, that was a big deal.
It was, and it was a national story. People were amazed that a 22-year-old, his first job out of college is going to be mayor of his hometown.
Very cool. Very cool. So are there meetings that you guys have where my name comes up and you're looking for some higher office? I mean, whatever I can do to help, let me know.
We are looking for, we absolutely are looking for our candidates to look for opportunities to step up into even higher office with greater responsibility and greater impact. So I think you should consider governor.
So you didn't see any interim steps there. It was from selectman in Brattleboro, from fence viewer to selectman, and gosh knows there was a gap there all the way up to governor. You guys feel like I'm ready?
You know, if anybody's ready.
That was an indictment of the whole state of Vermont that you just did there, Dennis Dyson. We'll take it, though. We're happy with it. Tell everyone where they can go to learn more about all the amazing things that you guys are doing there at the Victory Fund.
We are always at victoryfund.org, and we encourage people to look at the candidates that we have endorsed. And if you're interested in running for office or taking one of our trainings, we train people in campaigns four times a year throughout the country. You can also look at victoryinstitute.org, which is our C3 arm.
Yeah. Now, what about, can you say something about someone from being out of state? So I don't live anywhere near Tammy Baldwin. Why is it important for people who don't even live in the districts where the person is being elected to support them financially?
Well, in the case of Tammy, you know, the United States Senate impacts every American's life. The decisions that they make there are important, they make decisions for the entire country. So having an out voice there, even if it's not someone who represents your state, is important, because while she's going to represent the people of Wisconsin, she's also going to represent every LGBT American.
There you go.
In a way that no other member of the Senate can do. And I think that's true of the House as well. And if we're talking about the state legislatures, you know, we all have friends in every state.
So. Right. Yeah, it's pretty important. It's pretty important. Well, we love the work that you guys do over there. I'm excited. Gosh, I'm nervous about this whole governor thing, but I guess we'll start tomorrow. And people need to stroll on over to the website and learn about the great things that you're doing and subscribe to The Brief. How many subscribers are we at? Do we know?
We are just about 25,000.
We can do better.
We can
do better. And if someone wanted to email you and send you possible poll questions, you wouldn't turn them down?
Oh, I would welcome it. It would make my life a lot easier.
We are here to help. Dennis Dyson, it no longer is allegedly. You have now appeared on this show as So Gay. It will be archived for all the world to hear.
Well, it hasn't aired yet. Point that out.
Yes, it's good to reserve a little doubt in the field that you're in, Dennis. Thank you for that. Dennis Dyson, an absolute pleasure. We look forward to celebrating with you all in just a few weeks when we start electing all of these folks.
Thanks, Ken.
All the best.
Take care.
My strange nation has ocean on two sides and the Bama crimson tide in the south, tilted slightly toward the north. The immigrants pour forth seeking Phoenix and life hand to mouth. My strange nation tilts sharply to the right, with our leaders straight and white as our teeth. Our population's mixed, but our election's fixed in my strange nation.
All right, folks, that about wraps things up for this week's episode. A huge, huge thanks to Sharon Staple from the Anti-Violence Project and Dennis Dyson from the Victory Fund. Can I dork out for a second? I'm going to dork out for a second with you guys. This is just another one of those opportunities where I am so enormously, enormously thankful for the opportunity to just speak to these people who are doing such incredible work to raise up the voices of underrepresented populations, of our LGBT brothers and sisters who are fighting for equality, just for all of our allies out there who are trying to make this world a better place. And you guys can do it too. You can host your own radio show and get in touch with people. You can join up with the efforts of the Anti-Violence Project or the Victory Fund. You can just look what's happening in your local community, host a movie night, whatever it is that you want to do to get people out, because you have allies in your community. I promise you, you have allies in your community. You might just have to do something to get the ball rolling. So I support you in that. You guys know that. Send me an email. We would love to hear your guest ideas. Who do you want on this show? Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Check out thisshowissogay.com and learn all about the fun things happening with our upcoming guests. We have amazing upcoming guests in the next couple weeks. Ronnie Sandlow, who is just a hero in the higher ed world, my world, for researching about LGBT students and doing her part to really get words out there in print to bring attention to the experiences of the LGBT population, in particular LGBT college students. And then the week after that, Andrea James, who is just a hero, a hero, a hero. She is a writer, she is a producer, she is a director, she is an activist, and came straight from one of our listeners writing in and saying, hey, can you get her on your show? We reached out and we deliver. We deliver. That's what we try to do here. And of course, go to Facebook, type in The Show So Gay, join the thousands and thousands, truly thousands of people who like our show on there and get regular updates. You guys get out there, go do some incredible, incredible things. Use your voice the way that you know how to do it to make a difference in this world. And while you're doing it, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
My strange nation built on the backs of slaves who were sailed here across the waves from far away. This cruel experiment was ended by a president who was both a Republican and gay. My strange nation gave the Indians our germs. They surrendered on our terms, as in died. Their survivors filed appeals. So we gave them roulette wheels in my strange nation, America. But my strange nation has lost its mind again, sending young women and men off to war for reasons that aren't clear. Unless you're standing near to the rich and the righteous and the bored. And my strange nation, enamored of the cross, and who will win the toss of the coin? The circus and the bread distract us from the dead. In my strange nation, America. But my strange nation will surely come around, for you cannot hold us down for long. We'll sputter and we'll cough and throw the despots off and recover the soul that makes us strong. But loyal love for this land, for its mountains and its lakes, tornadoes and earthquakes, for its poets and pioneers, for its fetishes and fears, for its freedom of dissent, for its greasy garments.